Okay, now we're ready to get going. It is Sunday, December 17th, and we're in John 19, and Susan has a question. Fire away.
Yeah, when the people in the crowd were saying, you know, crucify him, they wanted, was it Barabbas?
Yep.
Release instead. Who was that in the crowd that religious people, or was that just the normal people, you know, in the villages and stuff, or whatever? Who was saying it all? Because there were so many people that followed him and stuff and knew of his miracles, so who was saying crucify him?
So who was wanting him crucified and wanting Barabbas released instead of clamoring to his defense, for example? Well, remember that the contrast has always been there between the support he saw, for example, at the triumphal entry, versus the antagonism he saw by the end of the week, which is where we are. So to some extent, I think it's safe to say that not all the crowds who were clamoring and cheering at the beginning of the week were committed followers. They were riding the wave of emotion. They were out there sort of saying, hey, what's going on? Can I play too? And we're going to even see examples in the text ahead of us of people who were followers of Jesus but kept it secret because they were afraid of the Jewish leadership. So Scripture does not tell us who was and wasn't in this crowd. We don't know the demographics of it. If we think about it a little bit, these trials have been going on overnight. There weren't people around when he was, for example, at the house of Annas or Caiaphas. A little bit of word may have trickled out. But by the time he's in front of Pilate and gets sent over to Herod and comes back to Pilate, it's daybreak. And it's past daybreak, and somewhere here soon we're going to see a reference to it being the sixth hour. Well, that would be what time? Yeah, that'd be about noon, because they start counting at 6 a.m., if I recall correctly. So we're well into the morning now, and there's plenty of opportunity for people to be up and about and word to be out that something's going on, so on and so forth. So there may be some people who have just come because of the ruckus, so to speak. But also remember that the leadership has been active all night. They went looking for false witnesses. They're stirring up the crowd to call for Barabbas. They are probably responsible for a decent percentage of the crowd that has gathered now. And if you're in that crowd as a Jewish citizen of Jerusalem and you don't have a horse in the race as far as your own perception of things goes, you're going to listen to the leadership of your own religion. And when those chief priests and Pharisees and scribes start calling out for this or the other and saying, tell him you want Barabbas, and you're probably going to go along. So I guess my answer to your question is, logically, most of this crowd is probably sheep who see the Jewish leadership as their shepherds. And so they're going along with what the Jewish leadership is trying to do and telling them to do. And at that point, if you're a follower of Jesus, and there aren't that many of them, it's a dangerous place to raise your voice. And we already know what happened to his most fervent, closest followers. They scattered and ran. All right. So we've been looking at this sequence of events. We've left John when we've needed to and crossed over to Matthew or Mark or Luke in order to follow the whole sequence, just to see how legal and illegal, and it's been mostly illegal, these whole proceedings have been. And we saw already 2 weeks ago that really the entire Jewish trial sequence was illegal. They had the conflict of interest because some of the leaders who were going to be judges were part of the arresting party. You can't do that, or if you do, you have to recuse yourself from being a judge. They didn't. They held the trial at night. Can't do that. They voted to convict him immediately after the trial. Can't do that. A vote to convict has to wait a day just to let people think it over and be sure. You need the testimony of at least two witnesses. They didn't have corroborating testimony from two witnesses. You can't use a defendant's own testimony against him, but not only did they use it against him, it was the only testimony they used to convict him. Everything about this trial was done contrary to their own legal code. And then when they passed him over to Pilate because they needed the Roman government's approval on a death sentence, we saw that things actually went okay. In terms of the Roman law, Pilate did what he was supposed to, right up until he came back out and said, "I find no guilt in this man." Because that's where it should have ended. But it didn't. And that's where Pilate made his mistake. And I think it's worthwhile to consider, and I don't have an answer to this necessarily, and we have a little bit more to say about Pilate here this morning, but I do ask myself sometimes, was Pilate a villain? Or was Pilate a victim? And I'm not 100% sure. Because what Pilate did wrong was to buckle to the pressure of the Jewish leadership and the crowd that they were fomenting. But in terms of the legal process, he was okay until that point. Pilate is not in an easy spot. On the one hand, the leadership, and we've talked about this before, they have to be careful because they don't want another messianic pretender rabble-rousing and starting a revolt among the people and giving Rome a reason to come in and crush the Palestine state, Judea. So since they don't recognize Jesus as the actual Messiah, they're naturally looking at him as a political threat to their stability. But Pilate doesn't have all the cards here either. He is responsible to his superior in the Roman executive branch for keeping the peace in Palestine. And he's got in front of him now, this morning, a very, very exercised Jewish leadership. The entire structural layer between him and the people of the district he's responsible for is here in front of him and very unhappy. And he could just say, "You know what? I'm calling out the soldiers and I'm just taking you guys home at spear point and be quiet. Get out of here." But that's not going to play tomorrow. So he's also thinking in terms of how do I make this work so that they're not completely frustrated and going to create more problems for me after today. See, he's got to think about this politically, not just legally. And as we commented last week, that's where things go wrong. Up until the point where Pilate was up through where Pilate was just thinking about this legally, everything went according to Roman law, and Jesus was found to have no guilt. But then the pushback came from the leadership, and Pilate began thinking politically. And that's when it turns south on the Roman legal side of everything that happened that night. So Pilate is trying to navigate a course between not wanting to convict an innocent man and not wanting to cause a riot himself within the state that he's responsible for. And it looks more and more as we read through these verses like the leadership is willing to cause a riot to try to get what they want here. That's Pilate's quandary. That's the vice that Pilate feels squeezing on him from both sides. So I don't know sometimes whether he's a villain or a victim. But he sent Jesus to Herod, something about which John says nothing, but we see it in the other Gospels. Herod sends Jesus back, because Jesus doesn't say anything to Herod. And then John picks it up with Pilate coming out and giving his ruling as if it happened right after the first visit to Pilate and not the second one. And that's where, that's at 1838. He went back outside to the Jews and told them, I find no guilt in him. And this is where John has jumped forward, because it's after the visit to Herod and then back again in the second appearance before Pilate that Pilate brings up the whole Barabbas idea. And that's where we are here in John 18:39. But you have a custom that I should release one man for you at the Passover. So do you want me to release to you the king of the Jews? Notice that what Pilate is doing here, and he's going to continue doing it through these next verses, he is desperately trying to find a way to let Jesus go. Desperately trying to find a way to let Jesus go. And there will even come a point here where he's not so concerned about letting Jesus go as he is about saving his own skin politically. We'll get to that. But Pilate wants out. Pilate is trying to wriggle out of the vice that he feels squeezing in on him. So he gives him the opportunity to let Jesus be the one who's released under their custom. That they cry out again, not this man, but Barabbas. And we know from the other Gospels that the leadership was stirring up the crowd to call for Barabbas. Barabbas was a robber and other things. John just doesn't give a lot of attention to that. So then we cross into chapter 19. Then Pilate took Jesus and flogged him. Now you ask yourself, wait a minute. If Pilate thinks he's innocent, then why would he do that to him? And I think the answer is, because at least if he flogs him and satisfies their bloodlust that way, Jesus lives. And Pilate gets out of this. And the soldiers twisted together a crown of thorns and put it on his head and arrayed him in a purple robe, and kind of sounds like a little bit of what they did over at Herod's place. They came up to him saying, Hail, King of the Jews, and struck him with their hands. Pilate went out again and said to them, See, I am bringing him out to you so that you may know that I find no guilt in him. So Jesus came out, wearing the crown of thorns and the purple robe. Pilate said to them, Behold the man. And the way I read this is Pilate saying, See, it's not like he's coming out of this unscathed. This is the first time he's been out of Herod's headquarters since he got there, that they've seen him, that the Jewish, that the crowd has seen him. And he's bloody and he's bleeding and he's, yeah. But that does not work. When the chief priests and the officers saw him, they cried out, Crucify him! Crucify him! Pilate still doesn't want to do that. So Pilate said to them, Take him yourselves and crucify him, for I find no guilt in him. It's a wonderful sentiment, Pontius. It won't work. Why not? Because they're not allowed to crucify him unless Rome approves it. And Pilate, just in the same breath, said, I find no guilt in him. So Rome has not approved a crucifixion. In this moment, it's quite the opposite. So he can say, you take him and crucify him. But he hasn't given them permission. He's done just the opposite. He said, I think he's innocent. Verse 7, the Jews answered him, we have a law, and according to that law, he ought to die because he has made himself the Son of God. When Pilate heard this statement, he was even more afraid. Now, I know I'm trying to psychoanalyze a character in history, and that's always dangerous. But I don't think Pilate was afraid simply because they said Jesus was claiming to be the Son of God. I don't think that made Pilate afraid in terms of, well, this is a more serious charge than I've been considering so far. No, I don't think Pilate particularly cares about claiming to be the Son of God. That's probably just madness. Pilate is going to care more about the claim they made earlier, that this guy claims to be a king. That was the concern. That was the claim that perked Pilate's ears up, because that's the threat to the emperor. Son of God could be construed as an empirical claim as well. Caesar was considered to be close to the gods. Yeah, maybe. But what I honestly personally think is going on here is Pilate is just seeing the depth of their commitment to wanting this guy killed. And that's why he's even more afraid, because he's realizing that the efforts he has just made to bring the guy out, punished, whipped, bleeding, the attempt to swap him for another prisoner, none of it's working. And now they're saying, we have a law, and according to the law, this guy has to die. I think that's what Pilate is now more afraid of. He sees a riot coming if he says no. So Pilate said to Jesus, whoops, sorry, I jumped a verse. So we're at the end of verse 8, he was even more afraid. Verse 9, he entered his headquarters again and clearly took Jesus back in with him and said to Jesus, where are you from? Which sounds a little bit like an odd question on the surface, but remember what has already happened. When somebody in the Jewish leadership mentioned that he was not only doing the stuff he did in Jerusalem and Judea, but also in Galilee, remember? Pilate's ears perked up and he said, oh, wait a minute, is this guy a Galilean? And that's when he sent him to Herod. But he didn't know if the guy was a Galilean. And Jesus didn't say a word in front of Herod. So Herod sent him back. And now Pilate is asking him point blank, where are you from? And in my own opinion, the subtext there is, please tell me you're from Galilee. Please tell me that I can send you back to Herod and categorically tell him, this is your case, not mine. I think Pilate is just desperately hoping that he can still refer this off to some other Roman territorial official and get it out of his court. But Jesus gave him no answer. So, verse 10, Pilate said to him, you will not speak to me? Do you not know that I have authority to release you and authority to crucify you? Which is absolutely true under Roman law. It is totally Pilate's call as the governor. As we've said before, he's not answerable to the Roman Senate. He's not answerable to the Jewish leadership. He is only answerable to the regional, whatever level above governor existed, that's the only person he's answerable to. He is appointed, not elected. But this is also Pilate's problem. He can release Jesus, or he can have him crucified. He could also do anything in between. But he knows he should release him. And it's becoming increasingly clear that the only other option he has with the Jewish leadership and the crowds is to crucify him. So while Pilate is expressing the extremes of his authority to Jesus to try to get him to cooperate, he's also expressing the sides of the very vice that is squeezing him more and more by the moment. And Jesus answered him, "You would have no authority over me at all unless it had been given you from above. Therefore, he who delivered me over to you has the greater sin." It almost, does it sound that way to you? It almost sounds to me like Jesus is trying to ease Pilate's conscience a little bit here. The sin isn't so much yours, Pontius, as it is the people who put you in this spot, the people who brought me here, the people who delivered me over to you. They have the greater sin. But that doesn't mean Pilate's without sin, because he is trying to play the politician. And in doing so, he is helping to carry out a gross injustice. And there's no getting around that. Whether you see Pilate more as a villain or as a victim, there is no getting around that. He aided and abetted what happened to Jesus on this day. From then on, verse 12, from then on, Pilate sought to release him. Well, he's been trying to release him every step of the way already. But it just reinforced his desire to find a way out of this that didn't involve nails. But the Jews cried out, "If you release this man, you are not Caesar's friend." That's a loaded term too. Friend of Caesar was an important thing to be. And this is where they can make trouble for Pilate. Yes, Pilate is the governor. Yes, Pilate has complete control over what he rules here. But choices still have consequences. And while Pilate has every legal authority to say, "Look, the guy's innocent, I'm releasing him," they can communicate things up above Pilate and spin this in a way that makes it look like he is not governing well, that he is not listening to the leadership that the empire is allowing to be in place and govern its own state under Pilate's watchful eye. They can make Pilate look bad. And implicitly, they're threatening to do just that. If you let this man go, then you are no Caesar's friend. You are no friend of Caesar. Everyone who makes himself a king opposes Caesar. So they're back to that. The claim they made earlier in the night, that he claims to be a king, and therefore he's a threat to Caesar. To claim to be a king means that he's guilty of what was called maiestas, fancy Latin word, related our word majesty, but maiestas was treason. Was claiming to have Caesar's authority when you didn't. claiming to have rule where Caesar actually had rule. And if Jesus is claiming to be a king, that's the issue in the eyes of Rome. Pilate's already talked to Jesus about this. Jesus has already told him, my kingdom is not of this world. It's not that kind of a kingdom. I'm not that kind of a king. That's not where the threat to Caesar is. You can relax. But this is where the crowd is, and this is what Caesar has to deal with, or what Pilate has to deal with. So, when Pilate heard these words, he brought Jesus out and sat down on the judgment seat at a place called the Stone Pavement, and in Aramaic, Gabbatha. This is to make an official, legal ruling. Now, it was the day of preparation of the Passover. It was about the sixth hour, there we go, coming up on noon. He said to the Jews, behold your king. I think he's a little frustrated, a little sarcastic. I do. They cried out, away with him, away with him, crucify him. Pilate said to them, shall I crucify your king? The chief priests answered, we have no king but Caesar. And in their determination to make sure that they express their rejection of the Messiah, they actually make a statement that rejects Yahweh as their king. We have no king but Caesar. We are good Roman citizens, so be a good Roman governor. Muriel, I see a hand.
We're very confused. When, back in verse 11.
Whoa, way back in 11. Okay, it's not that far.
We're still hung up on this, because what you're saying is making us more confused, not because you're confused.
Okay, verse 11. What's the question?
You would have no power over me if it were not given to you from above.
Right. Oh, I think it's very clear that Jesus means God. Yeah. But it's easy enough if this is the way, if these are his words, it's easy enough for Pilate to think of that in terms of his own boss and the emperor. But I'm confident Jesus means God.
And then, therefore, the one who handed me over to you is guilty of a greater sin. Is that Herod?
No, it's the leadership.
The Jewish leadership.
Yeah, it's the Jewish leadership. They're the ones who brought him to Pilate in the first place. At the end of the Sanhedrin trial, they want him killed, but that takes Roman approval, so they take him to the governor.
Okay.
So it's the Jewish leadership who delivered him over.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. I see that hand.
Yeah. The more interesting thing to me here, though, is not just the acknowledgement of the highest power, but just the fact that he answered is an acknowledgement of Pilate's power as well.
Okay.
Pilate's been sitting there saying, talk to me, talk to me, talk to me. I have authority over here, you. That's the point at which Jesus actually talks.
Ah.
And it leads you down the path. You know, we always wonder why the crucifixion. Well, the easy answer is it's God's plan. But the harder answer is Jesus actually acknowledged Roman power by succumbing to the crucifixion. He acknowledged it in the garden before he had to do it, and then he carried the cross the whole way to it.
Yes.
Because that, he never at any point undermines Pilate's power, even misused. And I find that very interesting.
You're right. At no point does Jesus undermine Pilate's power. And there are points along the way where he could have dodged what's coming. When Pilate said, where are you from? He could have said, I was born in Nazareth. I'm a Galilean. Boom! That's what Pilate needs to get him out of his own jurisdiction. He could have answered Herod when he was sent to Herod, but he didn't. There are things that Jesus could have done along the way here that may very well have kept him from going to the cross. But he knows that he's here to go to the cross. And he's letting it happen. And that's remarkable.
Well, you know, I think that's shadow when he says in the garden, the time, now the time has come that I might suffer and die. It's not like, okay, I can put this off for another month, another year. We know now's the time and the place it's got to happen.
That's right.
Therefore, I've got some hard decisions ahead of me.
My hour has not yet come. My hour has not yet come. Now the hour has come. Peter pulls his sword and cuts off Malchus' ear, and Jesus says, stop that. Shall I not drink the cup that the Father has given me?
It makes me wonder what would happen if Pilate had released him. I mean, he would have ended up dying at some point, but we'll never know because it didn't happen that way.
Right.
It's that whole God's plan. The easy answer is it's God's plan.
Right, yeah.
Yeah.
God said so, right?
Yeah. And the closer we get to the focal point, this is going to sound kind of over the top in language, but I mean it quite seriously. The closer we get to the focal point of all human history, which is what the crucifixion and resurrection are, the harder it is for us to say, but what if this had happened? Because it isn't what happened. And there is no point in debating ultimately what would have happened if he had spoken in front of Herod, what would have happened if he had admitted he was Nazarene, what would have happened if... That's not what happened. What happened is he let himself be led to the cross and died for us. And that's what matters. I'm a language teacher, as some of you know, on the side, and one of the things that I have to teach my students is the difference between the indicative mood of a verb, which describes what really is happening, and the subjunctive mood of a verb, which describes what might have happened, or what could happen, or what we wish happened. And when we're looking at the life and death and resurrection of Jesus, we have to stay very much in the indicative mood. And look at what really happened, because what might have happened didn't, and what could have happened didn't, and what we might wish would have happened for his sake didn't. What matters is that he did. Gus?
This charge I have received from my Father.
Isn't that great? And it's great that that's today's gospel. I have the authority to lay it down, and I have the authority to take it up again. Over against Pilate saying, do you not understand that I have authority to release you or authority to have you crucified? Yeah, that's fascinating. The different perspectives in the earthly kingdom and the heavenly kingdom and just where the authority lies. Yeah, that's great. Other thoughts? I thought I saw another hand as Gus was starting to ask a question. Yeah?
I just had a question because, you know, you talked about how under the Jewish law, the laws were broken over and over again.
Yeah.
But under Pilate, the law was not broken until he caved. So do you think that maybe, I don't know, it just kind of struck me that maybe Jesus chose to be crucified under Pilate because it broke Roman law because really he was supposed to be crucified under Herod? It was just kind of a thought that came. Just from what you're saying, from his birthplace, he should have been tried under Herod, correct?
Maybe.
Maybe.
I do not know the answer to who had proper legal jurisdiction here.
But it just kind of seemed to me like it was like, so Roman law, not only did he cave, but he really maybe wasn't supposed to be judged, but obviously it was part of God's plan, otherwise it wouldn't happen that way.
Yeah.
But he could have. I mean, when Pilate asked him, where are you from, if he had said Galilee, he would have gone to Herod right there.
Yeah.
And he didn't take that opportunity.
But see, there are a couple questions here, and ultimately they don't matter. But let me walk through them. Number one, who actually did have the proper jurisdiction? And the answer is, I'm not sure. Yes, Jesus was from Nazareth, so maybe it should have been Herod. Then again, Jesus was born in Bethlehem of Judea, so maybe it should have been Pilate. Or maybe though neither one of those things matters, and it's just a matter of where he made his residence, in which case he's an itinerant preacher, and I'm not sure at all. Okay? So I don't know who properly had jurisdiction. Without knowing more about the law of the time, there's arguments to be made both ways. Would it have been any different if he had gone to Herod and he had answered Herod's questions? Would Herod have done anything different? We don't know. We never will. Here's the greater question. Was he guilty? No. That's what really matters. He was convicted and executed, but he was not guilty of what he was charged for. And that is the thing that matters the most, because that is precisely at least a piece of why the substitutionary atonement is what it is. Jesus, as an innocent, died, taking on the death that we, as guilty, should receive. And that doesn't matter whether it was Herod or Pilate. But it was Pilate.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's just the way it unfolded. That's the way it unfolded. Yeah, Pilate gave in to peer pressure, underling pressure.
Yeah. You know, it's kind of humbling when you stop thinking about it. It didn't really matter if it was Pilate or Herod. Christ would have still intervened in his fight because the time was right. So it kind of makes us feel rather insignificant a little bit.
Thank God that we are insignificant on this point, because this is everything that needed to happen for God to save us. So, literally, thank God that we that we don't have that kind of influence. I mean, the real driving force in this story is the Jewish leadership. That's clear. Pilate contributed, but he contributed because of the pressure being put on him by the Jewish leadership, and that's the same leadership that had conducted the whole first half of the night's trials. So, yeah. Okay. Anything else there? Because we are about to shift gears. Okay. We have no king but Caesar. So, chapter 19, verse 16. So Pilate delivered him over to them to be crucified. Now, if it sounds odd to say he delivered him over to them, and he thinks, wait a minute, he gave them back into the Jewish leadership so they could crucify him, but they're not supposed to. Well, number one, he's giving in and letting them have their death sentence. And number two, if you read the other Gospels, it's not the Jewish leadership that takes him and puts the nails in his hands. It's still Roman soldiers. John doesn't make that particularly clear. John doesn't go into that level of detail here, but it's still Roman soldiers. Take a look at Matthew 27 to get a clearer picture of it, but I'm not going to go there now. I wanted to jump back and forth and get a whole clear picture of the trial sequence, but I have no particular interest in going back and forth and getting a whole clear picture of the crucifixion sequence. That was never my goal. I don't want to do a harmony of the Gospels for the rest of the books. And to be quite honest, getting into the details of the crucifixion is a very difficult thing for me to do. Just personally, emotionally, it's a very difficult thing for me to do. So I'm on this side of the lectern, and I'm not going to do it. Anybody seen the Last Temptation of Christ? Not the Last Temptation. What's the one that Mel Gibson did? The Passion of the Christ. The Passion of the Christ. How many have seen that? See, almost everybody in the room. I have not, nor do I intend to. I just can't handle it. All right. So they took Jesus, and he went out, bearing his own cross, to the place called the place of a skull, which in Aramaic is called Golgotha. How many have been to Jerusalem? Show of hands. Really? Just one?
I've been over it.
On a clear day, I'll bet even.
Yeah, it was. It was like, what's that?
I've never been there either. And given that so few of us have, then let me show you a couple things. This is not the most critical controversy in history, but there are arguments about just exactly where the crucifixion took place. Fundamentally, the arguments come down to two sites that are about 100 yards apart. This is really important. But I really like this. It's from a study Bible, probably the NIV study Bible, but I can't recall. But it is a drawing of Jerusalem at the time of Christ. And what we're talking about here, first of all, although you can't see it, see if this thing will work for me. Yeah, thanks. Now you're not going to work for me. The little pointer was working just fine before class. Now it's not. Well, so be it. You're looking at the city from the south, a little bit southeast. And this whole low valley that's running along the foreground here, that's the Kidron Ravine. Remember that? That's where Jesus led his disciples across and to Gethsemane, which would be off to the lower right in what's not drawn here. What we're looking for, to the upper right, you can see the Temple Mount, just the other side of that big, long building. And then come west from there, and you see a lot of houses and a residential quarter. And then over at the top left, do you see the towers on the wall? Come to the right from those towers, and you can see an L shape where the wall running east and west meets a wall that's coming in from the north. You see that? That's the place we're talking about. That's the place we're talking about. The east-west running wall is called the first wall because it's older. And the wall that starts from there and runs north before it comes back across and encloses that northern section of the city, that is called the second wall, for obvious reasons. And right where those two walls meet, you have the Garden Gate, or Gennath Gate. And this is the spot we're talking about, just outside that gate. And you can see that they've labeled Golgotha there. One of the things I like about this drawing is that you can see where it looks like the ground is dug out, like Golgotha is part of a pit or a dig, and it is. It's an old quarry. That's what Golgotha was. It's an old quarry. And so we think of Jesus as being crucified on the Mount of Calvary, right? And we think of it as a knoll or a hill. But Golgotha was an old quarry. And so the ground went down. But then in the quarry, it was dug deeper around the edges than it was in the middle. And so you did have a raised terrain in the middle of the old quarry. And that's why Scripture can very accurately talk about a hill or a knoll, or in Hebrew, a rush. They can both be true. This is an overhead map of that detailed area. You see the first wall coming across the bottom of the screen. You see the second wall going north before it swings around to the east. And what you have here are two roads coming in. The west road runs along the outside of the wall. That's coming west from Joppa and that territory. And that's a major road into Jerusalem. And then the north road would be coming down from places like Shechem. And that's not as major a road as it used to be, because when they built the second wall, they also built the upper gate, and there's a new north road. But a lot of people still come down the old route, right along the outside of the walls, and they all come into the city at the Geneth Gate. Okay? That's the territory we're talking about. And you can see the big oval, and that is the old quarry. The dotted lines represent what they think are some other terrain points, but that's a hard thing to judge. Geologically, they have reasons to think that. But you got to understand what happened to Golgotha in the years that followed. For example, try to think who it was. I think it was the Emperor Hadrian, but I may have that name wrong. In the second century, built a temple dedicated to the Roman goddess Venus. And that temple was built east and west, right across the top end of Golgotha. You see the letter Y in a circle? That was underneath the western end of that temple. They had to backfill the quarry in order to build that temple. And then they backfilled the whole thing, and they built a forum, a plaza, over the rest of it. So that all got filled in. And then Constantine came along, and he became a Christian, and he wanted to do something with temples. So he built a temple. I'm not sure he was... There are questions about just how Christian Constantine was. This temple was dedicated to Jupiter. But that took that was also built on this site. So a lot of stuff happened on this site. The reason why we think we know where things happened, especially the crucifixion, is not so much the actual archaeology of the site as it is the archaeology that shows us what the site was like, coupled with historical accounts that we have. Visitors to Jerusalem in the second century, end of the first century, second century, were consistently told that the site of Jesus' resurrection was under a major road of the time. And when you look at the description that they give of what that road was, it seems like there's only one possibility. Basically, the route of, first of all, that whole area becomes enclosed within the city. You've got the first wall, the second wall that show on this map. But they build a third wall that's totally off this map to the north and the west. And another wall after that. The city kept growing, and they kept enclosing it with walls. So this becomes part of the city. And pretty much parallel to the west road, they built what was called the Decimanus, which is a major boulevard. And right along the path of the old north road, they built a huge, wide street with colonnades and very fancy. I can't remember the name of it now. So in the second century, when the Christians were saying, hey, we can show you where it was, they always pointed to the same spot on the Decimanus, which was the old west road. Now, you take that old west road and you straighten it out, and you just about come straight through the X that's there at the southern end of Golgotha. And that is where we think the crucifixion took place. We think it was there on the slope of the southern slope of the old quarry.
How
A lot of people thought it was up where the Y is for a long time. That doesn't work. And the reason it doesn't work is in the text. So let's go back to that. We were in 1914. Now it was the day of preparation of the Passover. It was about the sixth hour. He said to the Jews, "Behold your king." They cried out, "Away with him, away with him." Pilate said, "So I crucify your king. No king but Caesar," so he handed him over. So they took Jesus, and he went out bearing his own cross to the place called the place of a skull, which in Aramaic is called Golgotha. Nobody knows why it was called the place of the skull. Maybe the excavation looked a little bit like a skull. Nobody knows. It's not an old burial ground or anything like that. There they crucified him, and with him two others, one on either side, and Jesus between them. Pilate wrote an inscription and put it on the cross. It read, "Jesus of Nazareth, the King of the Jews." Many of the Jews read this inscription, for the place where Jesus was crucified was near the city, and it was written in Aramaic, in Latin, and in Greek. Okay, think for a minute, just practically. A cross, a guy nailed to it, a sign on it says King of the Jews. Or Jesus of Nazareth, King of the Jews. How big is the lettering on that sign?
Very little.
It's not that big. It can't be that big. If you want to read that, and the cross is at the position marked Y on that map, if you want to read that from the city, you're going to have to be up on top of the second wall, and it's going to have to be the size of a small billboard. No, doesn't work. Maybe if you're on the North Road, but notice your scale. From the North Road, that's 75, 80 yards away. 4-inch letters? Maybe. But down here at X, which matches historically with the Decimanus that would later be built right across the site, and that Christians in the second century would always point to tell people that's where it happened. Now you got people coming down from the North Road, people coming in from the West Road. They're only 50, 60 feet away from the cross. Yeah, you can read those. You can read 4-inch letters from there. So it makes sense from the text, as well as making sense from the archaeology and the history that we have, that that's probably the place where the crosses were erected. Not an important theological point, but still an interesting question. So I share it with you. And that's where we have to stop. It's 10:20. Any last thoughts, real quick? We'll get back into this next week. All right, let's pray. Father, it is a marvel that your Son could have stopped this in so many ways. With his spiritual authority, his heavenly authority, even just with maneuverings, even by just opening his mouth when he had the opportunity to during this night, and he did not do it. Like a lamb to the slaughter, he held his tongue and allowed them to lead him to his own death. For our sakes, grant that we would never forget those three words, "for our sake," as we marvel at the passive obedience that he showed. Because he had the authority that our gospel reading today in John 10 talks about, to lay down his own life and to pick it up again. And that is what he would ultimately do, not only lay down his life, but pick it up again 3 days later. Thanks be to God. In Jesus' name, amen.